Welcome to episode 59 of the High Tech Forum podcast. Today I've got my guest is Will Reinhart, who was with us on the podcast 3 years ago for a discussion of Cambridge Analytica and fake news.
Yeah.
And this fake news thing, we don't ever really seem to escape it. But let me tell folks who you are.
Yeah.
So Will's a senior research fellow now at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. Mm-hmm. And for people who aren't complete and total internet nerds, Utah State was one of the original universities connected to the ARPANET.
Yeah.
So back in like 1970 or so, I think, is when they were first connected.
So where I went to high school, even though I'm affiliated with Utah State now, my background goes back to University of Illinois. And in particular, my high school was connected to Plato, the Illinois video text software project back in the 1970s. And so even when I was a student in the late 1990s, we had super fast broadband internet, and it was something to behold.
Yeah, Mosaic was University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. That played a bit of a role in the development of the
minor
internet. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, added pictures and graphics to links. Yeah, cool. So, one of the things that Washington or that broadband policy people in general are really preoccupied with right now is the infrastructure plan that has been proposed by President Biden. And it's seems like every administration now has to have a broadband infrastructure plan. Well, I remember when Chairman Pai became chairman rather than commissioner, and he laid out his priorities at the FCC during his term in office. Mm-hmm. Rural broadband, improving the quality of rural broadband, was at the top of the list.
Yeah,
but typically goes hand in hand with a focus on improving the subscription rates for broadband in urban areas where it's plentiful, but there's still a subscription gap.
Yeah.
And so it becomes, quickly this issue becomes a sort of a test of ideologies, because there are free market approaches and very government heavy approaches. And safe to say, although we haven't seen all the details of the Biden plan to really thoroughly evaluate it, this is a pretty government heavy approach, isn't it, Will?
Yeah. Well, one thing I would mention, at least with that first comment, which is the political nature of it, I think there's also this really interesting divide at the federal level and then the local level, because mostly at the local level, most of the local level politics is very much flipped. They just see, broadband infrastructure as a rural problem, and it's not an urban problem, right? That even despite the fact that most people who aren't connected are in fact urban individuals, right? The biggest group of people who aren't connected are in urban areas. They're not in rural areas. It's still thought of, the problem writ large is thought of as a rural area. But even I'm doing kind of a dance around the problem here, which is that there's this clear infrastructure. Well, the question is whether or not there is an infrastructure problem. And then there's a broader, more holistic issue of the digital divide, people not connected. So those are two very different things, but often, included when we're talking about broadband issues or broadband policy writ large.
Yeah, a couple of podcasts ago, I had John Horrigan on.
Yeah.
And we really tried to unpack that. It just doesn't seem to make any difference, like how hard we try to clarify the fact that the digital divide is primarily a social issue.
Yeah.
For every one person who cannot get access to a broadband, high quality broadband network at any cost, there are at least three who could, provided they had the right combination of interest, income, and information. Mm-hmm. And so policymakers, especially in Congress, they like to talk about this, the digital divide, and pretend that it can be solved by construction projects.
Yeah. That 3-to-1 ratio is probably more like 1-to-10, right? Because it's only about 3 or 4% of all people in the United States who aren't connected to the internet because they don't have a access to it, at least according to the census. Now, there's the price question, right? Now, can you afford it? And those two things are typically bundled together, but I think I personally separate them out very cleanly, even though they're very similar sorts of, And most people kind of couple those things together, but I think that very, very clearly you have to say, hey, you know, an issue of infrastructure, if you don't have infrastructure deployment, is very, very different than a problem about demand. And demand or relevancy, which is something, you know, which is the biggest portion of the reason why people aren't connected, because they don't see it as relevant in their lives. That the 2/3 of all individuals, that I think is the big problem that we haven't even touched, which, you know, I know John at Pew, he's done a lot of work on this, and you find something very similar, that even if you were to give people access to the internet, something like, you know, 7 out of 10 or 2 out of 3 people would not consume it, who do not currently consume it for any price. They wouldn't use it. And that's that's a really big problem that does not seem to be at all discussed within Washington. Though it's something as being from rural area. I mean, I'm from rural Illinois. I recognize this very, very clearly. It's a problem for neighbors of my grandparents, my grandmother, who I need to go and see in a couple of weeks, but yeah.
Yeah. I've got relatives, semi-rural kind of exurbs in Texas who have this problem, where the only wired service they can get is DSL, and sometimes it's DSL at like 3 or 4 megabits per second. I mean they chose to live in places that didn't have cable service, and they're okay with that because, you know, DirecTV. But yeah, the internet thing turned out to be a pretty big factor for those folks. So There are some interesting approaches to improving, you know, broadband quality. I mean, I think the discrepancy between, is it 1 in 3 or 1 in 10?
Yeah.
Has a lot to do with how you define broadband.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you define it as, if you're pretty permissive and you include, obviously, geosynchronous satellites, basically everybody in America can get it if they can pay the price, because, you know, they're but, you know, we don't typically consider geosynchronous to be a total substitute for a terrestrial service because of the latency and you know, limited performance, and the price is high, and blah blah blah.
Do you think that's changing, though? I mean, with Starlink, Starlink, at least from the people that I've been talking to, and I work with a lot of state legislators and people in, you know, in rural areas, and the people who are using currently Starlink, especially in Washington State, are claiming that it is transformative. They, you know, a lot of people are swearing by Starlink.
Funny you should mention that.
Yeah.
The last podcast we did, which I just published it yesterday before we're recording this, is about Starlink. I recorded with Tom Evslin, and Tom joined the Zoom call through Starlink.
I'll have to check that out. Yeah, I'm fascinated by this.
Yeah, but Starlink, I was saying geosynchronous. So Starlink is non-geosynchronous. It's low Earth orbit.
Yeah.
And so the difference is that, you know, the Starlink constellation is 500 kilometers up, and the geosynchronous is like 22,000 miles. And the latency with Starlink is like 45 milliseconds. So it's perfectly fine for voice communication. I mean, the interaction, you know, that I had with Tom was just as interactive as this is. And, you know, we're both on wired connections here, right? Probably.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I'm on fiber. Very, very nice fiber. Very cheap fiber, interestingly enough.
So we won't promote the company, because I think that's sort of like product placement. So, and we don't, we're kind of hard to talk about Starlink without doing some of that. But
Yeah.
That company is amazingly reluctant to talk to the public or to journalists about what they're up to. I mean, they don't. I have some buddies who work there doing engineering, and I wanted to get one of them on the podcast, because I figured a dialogue between Tom and Tom's got a long experience doing networking, and network policy. And he used to run the original WorldNet dial-up internet service for AT&T back in the back in the day. I guess it was in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
Then introduced flat rate monthly pricing for broadband service. And he had a lot of questions he wanted to ask an engineer. I had an engineer lined up, but Starlink says, no, he can't go on the show. We don't approve of that. So they wouldn't even take questions in writing and come back with answers. They're just like, yeah, we don't care what the public thinks.
That is actually the entire Musk, contingent of services. They do, effectively no advertising. Tesla doesn't do advertising.
Mm-hmm.
They'll do some product outreach, but anyway, I think that's...
Yeah, it's sort of like if you have to ask the price, you can't afford it. I mean, if you have to ask about the product, you're not cool enough for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, Reddit seems to be the vehicle for the Starlink beta, which they originally called the Better Than Nothing beta. it's all promoted, and the tech support and everything is basically, through Reddit.
That's interesting. I didn't even realize that. I'll have to check out that subreddit.
Oh, yeah. And they have, people on there have figured out, what to do about the tree problem.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, got to have an unobstructed view of the northern sky. So,
yep.
And if you live in a remote area, you're probably going to have some trees around you, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of places. So if that's a problem, there are tree trimmers that specialize in mounting Starlink dishes in trees. So up high in the tree, just, cut off a few limbs around it and run the cable down, and boom, you're in business. Nothing
That's
to
great.
It. Yeah. It depends on how you... And 5G. It's 5G terrestrial. They're specialized 5G uncapped internet plans that are on offer now from T-Mobile, Verizon, and AT&T, and with various combinations of price points and features that are, I've tried one of those. I tried the one from T-Mobile.
Yeah, how
and
was it?
And it worked perfectly fine. I mean, it wasn't really good for my particular setup because I have a home office, and so I have a really complicated network topology.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Wi-Fi router hub 5G gateway that it comes with is kind of geared for the more ordinary network where it's your Wi-Fi. You control your Wi-Fi network through that device.
Mm-hmm.
And it handles all the DNS and all the DHCP. And I'm just not set up that way. I mean, what I want is I basically want a 5G modem.
I think that that's much more like a directed hotspot or router. So, and I know a lot of people who are younger that this is their sort of, for us who are really into computers and have wires going everywhere or the modems and repeaters set up. I think that it's just a very different sort of way of interacting with the internet than somebody who's potentially just lived, or had hotspots throughout their lives or just used it as a hotspot. And I know a lot of folks like this. They've got, they have a phone, they have the phone, they use it as a hotspot, and they've got a computer, they've got a laptop. And those are the two connections to the internet. I mean, these are mostly younger people. I don't think I'll ever be able to give up my desktop, but it's moving away from this. It very much is a whole bunch of new users coming into this space who are going to slowly, I think, shift the competitive space in pretty dramatic ways because of the nature of what they're and how they're consuming internet access.
I think there's a really big element of that in the prescriptions in broadband policy about, what is broadband and what kind of broadband do we need? Like the Biden administration, I mean, he's got Tim Wu, and Tim Wu is part of that Susan Crawford generation that, they're very dogmatic. The only kind of network that's acceptable is symmetrical fiber. Has to be like dark fiber pulled by the government. Maybe you have a government agency, a co-op or something that manages the service. But the infrastructure is a big government civil engineering project. And fiber is what we want. Because after all, when you do all serious uses of computers involve sitting at a desk in front of a big screen typing away. It's not holding something in your hand and, well, you know, pulling it out of your pocket while you're talking to a friend at Starbucks. No, that's not computing. It's like, you know, so you have this one mindset where it's sort of stationary based. And, you know, obviously, if you start with the other mindset where, you know, you start with mobile first. Well, then it's simply then the residential broadband simply becomes an issue of how can you optimize the wireless network when it doesn't have to be mobile?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are things that that T-Mobile and Verizon and AT&T are figuring out how to do. When you mount an antenna, like a millimeter wave antenna on the outside of your house, pull a wire in there from the antenna and connect that to your broadband gateway, you got a whole different level of connectivity than when you just have you're counting on the signal penetrating your walls and windows to get to your mobile handheld device inside your home.
Yeah.
There's a whole different set of constraints. And so it turns out the definition of broadband, you know, determines, well, what kind of systems are we going to count? How are we going to count the unconnected? And who are we going to spend money on? And how are we going to prioritize? And that's why, the maps are such a big deal in the political realm about this.
And, you know, and going back to what you'd said earlier about Ajit Pai, you know, one of the things that he'd done, just to put a fine point on it, is this, you know, the RDOF project, the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund. And at least in this first round that was finished up, was that beginning of this year? End of 2020, beginning of 2021. You know, one of the big things, or maybe it was 2019 and 2020, where when RDOF was finished. But one of the big criticisms of that auction was that too many wireless ISPs had gotten involved, that they were able to provide the service at this service rate, which is lower than just about everyone else. And that's also another interesting kind of addendum to all of the things that we're talking about with the Biden administration plan and not just their plan, you know, but also what's going on in the Senate and a whole bunch of different variations of the Senate and what's also going on in the House, that it seems that some of those things are effectively lost. Like the lessons haven't really, I feel like we don't really know how things are going to end up through the most recent RDOF process. You know, most of that money is not going to go out, or that will finish going out at the end of next year, if I recall correctly. It was 2020 that this happened, the beginning of 2020. Needless to say, all this is to me just it's all of a really, really complicated problem, because you have multiple different regions that have very different demands. You have very different markets in rural areas. Some areas probably will be best served by something like Starlink. Maybe some other ones will be best served by, you know, the direct satellite connection, the millimeter wave connection that you're talking about. I know there's been a lot of work in the UK on this that I've been following, that I'm really interested to see what happens as well there. And I feel like all of that, the movement and the jostling, all of that has just been completely underappreciated in the highest echelons of power here in Washington. And in particular, you know, one of the big things that I feel that most people aren't taking account of is that RDOF money is going out. And so there are a lot of people who are going to be focused on construction who work in the communication industry. And they're going to have, I mean, this is a boom time for them. And it's just, if you put more money into the system, you're not really going to be able to get any more output. You know, there's already massive increases in demands for the primary inputs into fiber and into labor. And labor is a pretty big component of this. And so I've been talking with some folks who work in the construction industry in this space, and you know, they're basically, you know, booked until 2023 at least. And you want to put more money into this, you know, it's rate limited. There's only so much that we can do in a given amount of time, because there's only so many people who are working on communication in the labor industry. So it's not even like you would get these projects anyway, unless these projects basically were already determined going to happen. You know, so what you end up doing is just speeding up a decision that's already made. You don't really change what the dynamic looks like in any meaningful way. You just kind of speed up the timetable of what those outputs look like, or what the new projects look like.
Well, it's like that hurry up and wait.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask about that because there is several billion dollars have already been allocated to rural broadband that have not been spent. And so the question is, well, it's been allocated for years, so why hadn't it been spent? And part of the reason was, well, spending it is complicated. I mean, spending it and you
It's
got,
not
well, I
easy.
mean, like you say, you get, there's a limited pool of qualified personnel that can install this stuff. And I mean, you could train a bunch of people up, I guess, to do at least part of it. But yeah, we've been spending the money about as fast as we can for, 4 or 5 years now. It's just that it's a big country. And there's a limited labor pool. So I guess one of the I tend to see these things at some level as kind of simplistic. They're market approaches and they're government approaches. And in order to make a case for the government approaches, and some people just think it's really basically an inherent monopoly, that broadband is a natural, it was one of these so-called natural monopolies. And I think that kind of thinking was probably justifiable maybe 20 years ago before we really understood the role that technology can play in making alternatives less expensive. I think it's probably not as significant today, but to a certain extent, I think the door or the window is closing on the people that think really broadband infrastructure is a government responsibility and always should be, because of the emerging competitive alternatives in 5G and low Earth orbit and other things that that we don't even have time to talk about now. But if you look at the, you want to make a case for a really prominent role for government in the creation of future networks, you have to rely on data that's fairly dated. I mean, because if you, we've always been at least, you have always used data that's at least 1 to 3 years old to assess broadband deployment. And it's one of the things that really frustrates me about that annual report that the FCC gives Congress about, the whether we have effective, whether we're making effective progress towards the universal deployment of advanced telecommunications facilities. We don't, but if you had the data that was completely up to date, you'd capture the construction activity that's being done by, the wireline providers. And I know CenturyLink, they're the carrier where I live in Colorado, is they're just all in for fiber. I mean, what they're doing is, they're not replacing, but adding fiber as an alternative across probably half their footprint. And yeah, it's symmetrical. It's the dream of the future proofers in the Senate, symmetrical gigabit service, $65 a month, no data caps. I mean, who can say no to that? But they're doing that, and the cable companies keep on jacking their speeds up. I mean, my plan that I bought that used to be 940 down is now 1200 and actually measures at about 1300, so more than a gigabit. And this is what the conversation should be about, I think, is like, what's going on today? So when you hide the, you claim that the goal is to create a future-proof network, then it kind of gives you a way to avoid addressing the question of whether the network you're proposing and requiring by specifications is adequate for today's needs. I mean, is it
And if it
present
exists
proof?
already, right? If that network already effectively exists, it's like, why are we going to build a second network that does exactly the same thing, or try to pump money into an area that isn't going to, that isn't going to have the kind of benefits that we would want, even if we did believe that government should be supporting those elements.
And it used to be that, in this debate has obviously gone on since the 90s in broadband policy. And it used to be fashionable for the advocates of the more government-centric approach, which, I mean, I'm not saying that government has no role. They clearly have a role. And there's, you can't build a network without permitting and without access to rights of way. And there's all kinds of government involvement. Even if they're not paying a dime of the cost, it's an interaction between government and industry in any case. So it's just a question of sort of emphasis. But the folks that wanted government to play a really strong role in it would always argue that, well, the service, our broadband service in the U.S. is just really crappy compared to what people in other countries get.
Yeah.
And so they would like compare, you know, this is the Susan Crawfords. They would compare some bizarre data set from the United States against like the very best neighborhoods in Stockholm that had fiber and the best parts of South Korea that had, you know, had just installed, you know, GPON or, you know, the parts of Tokyo where people all are all in high rise buildings. And so they, there are some countries that made a real issue out of installing fiber optic networks starting around, you know, around 2000. even before Verizon started doing building Fios in the United States, they, you know, they were doing that. And that's just, that's the way broadband networks are built in East Asia.
In case of Korea, it was forced when they did an upgrade to their electrical system in the late 2000s, and there was forced upgrades too. So people couldn't consume at a lower level. I mean, that's something I don't think was very well appreciated, that there was a whole bunch of forced, there was a government supported but forced upgrade system that happened. I think it was in 2005 and 2006. But I remember last time I really, really did a deep dive in the international price comparison space, that was pretty evidently clear. The other thing that really surprises me is, you know, the big piece of, and I'm trying to do, you know, in the next couple of weeks, hopefully I'll come out with this analysis, but a lot of those reports is, you know, the big one is the New America Foundation. I forget the name, exact name, but yeah, the COC report, right? and what always bothered me about that, and still what bothers me about that, is none of it's indexed, none of it's properly indexed. So you've got the price, right? But then you also have the output, and so the question then becomes, well, wait a second, does the price itself, is the price reflective of what actual needs and consumption are of the locality, in the sense that, you know, if you've got a super fast internet service in Japan, but no one's really consuming anything, right? I mean, let's just assume that they aren't consuming video content. If there's no demand for consumption of video content, then the value of that service really isn't on par with another place that has the exact same speeds that is demanding a whole bunch of content or is getting a whole bunch of content. This is a welfare analysis, really. And the FCC has done this for a couple of years. They've actually done this kind of indice through their international broadband report. And the census does this. It's a very traditional way of doing a welfare or what's called a hedonic regression model. And universally, like when you put in the United States and you put in our prices and you put in our downloads and you put in all like all these other these factors that really do matter, you know, United States basically comes out, you know, towards the top of the pack, not at the very, very beginning. I think there's probably still progress to be made, but you know, we come in like fifth, sixth, seventh, usually within each of these indices, which is, I think, pretty good. The question of whether or not you need a entire regulatory system added on top of that, a price regulatory system to really get even better prices, I think is probably, it's not abundantly clear, at least on the face of it.
And well, even if all you at is raw speeds, just look at the speed test by Ookla numbers worldwide. The only countries that, I mean, the U.S. is, I think, currently around 9, 10, 11, 12, something like that for download speeds and fixed location broadband. But you look at who's ahead of us, and it's like Hong Kong, which isn't really a country, you know, South Korea, Singapore.
Ookla used to do a breakout of the United States, each of the states, and then compared to the rest of the countries. I don't think they do that anymore. That was always my favorite to look at, because then you could actually say, New York is the size, right? New York is the size of Hong Kong, so might as well just include New York State itself in that model. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it was fun to compare the U.S. states to the European countries.
Yeah,
because they're, you know, I mean, it is kind of roughly a federal system, and it, you know, you get units of similar population, and it turns out of the top 10 fastest, if you considered U.S. states as countries, then half of the top 10 fastest countries were American states. So and they're typically in the East Coast.
Rich, I mean, they're rich states with a big population, right, or a relatively dense population.
Yeah, I mean, Delaware always has done well. And that was even before anybody ever knew that Joe Biden was ever going to be president, when it was conventional wisdom he never would be. Anyhow, so what I was trying to say is that the used to be the debate was all about speed, but, you know, the sort of pro-government folks lost that debate because, as you say, you know, you compare the U.S. speeds and U.S. consumption because we use more data.
Yes, yes.
We consume more data in the United States than people in any other country do, with the exception of mobile data usage in Japan is the highest of any country in the world. And I think a lot of that has to do with they're measuring the hour-long subway commutes into Tokyo, where people are watching and streaming video on their phones, you know, as they're coming to work. So, but yeah, our speeds are fine, and our speeds are increasing, you know, at a higher rate than most other countries are. And that's really just because, well, we're doing pretty well with the fiber build, but, you know, and the pressure for that is that, you know, we have universal coaxial cable in the U.S. and there aren't very many. There aren't any other large countries that can say that. The closest you get to the kind of penetration the U.S. has with cable modem is small countries like Belgium and Netherlands, Sweden and Denmark, and they tend to be the countries that also are leaders in installing, you know, ultra-size high-speed fiber, because if you are a telephone company and you want to compete with cable modem, well, the only way you can really do that is with fiber.
Yeah.
And even UK, I mean, the half the population of the UK that can get cable modem service have the fastest, download speeds in the country. But, you know, so it shifted away from speed, and now it's about price again. And so, yeah, you mentioned the cost of connectivity survey, which, you know, we've talked about in great detail here, had George Ford on a while back. It's got cherry picking issues, but even that thing, it notes that, well, actually, when you correct for population density and speed, the prices in the U.S. are pretty much the same as they are in Europe. It's like within pennies, you know, in the cities that they looked at. And boy, they really don't like it when you quote that, that lied back at them.
Yeah.
But it gets to the question of, well, there's something kind of dubious about trying to assess prices on a cost per megabit basis.
Yes. Yes.
It's not linear. And so
no,
the value is certainly not linear.
Yes.
And well, it's nice to have, you know, gigabit service. It's probably not, you know, 100 times nicer to have gigabit than to have, say, 10 megabits per second.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not the same as the difference between 10 megabits per second and nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah. So how do you assess that? And
you do a market analysis, right? I mean, you've got to do a complicated, you have to do a somewhat complicated market analysis, and you have to figure out individuals' willingness to pay for prices in each of these markets, given, you know, their consumption patterns. This is, I mean, it's complicated stuff, and people, I mean, you know, people who do this sort of analysis, they make tens of thousands of dollars for these market studies in order to figure out if there is value to put a new system into an area.
Well, and if you're an investor that's committing, you know, private capital into a project like this, you really want to know, how likely are you to get enough signups to get a decent return on your investment, given, you know, the sort of what people really value in these systems and what they say what they'll tell, like, a poll taker or something.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is just learning. I mean, when I worked at ITIF, we did this report on international broadband comparison between the U.S. and OECD countries.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And one of the things we discovered in the course of doing that is the pricing strategy for ultra high speed broadband in the United States is very different at the time, and it probably hadn't changed that much. Very different than it was in Europe. Like, we charge more money. Our ISPs charge more money for the very highest speed plans than many of the European countries did. Yep. But we had lower prices for the entry-level plans.
Yep.
And so in a way, the pricing structure for broadband in the U.S., it kind of mirrors the tax system. So it's kind of graduated.
Yeah. And it's very progressive, right? You're exactly right.
Yeah. So yeah, we call that progressive pricing. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that's what you want, because at the low end, you've got a lot of people that don't have any broadband. And so what does it take to get them to sign up?
Yeah.
And it's certainly not all a question of price. It's the three I's, like I was saying, but having a lower price helps. I mean, all other things being equal, you know, it's a lot easier for someone who's really struggling economically to sign up for a Internet Essentials plan than to pay full freight, you know, 50, 60 bucks a month, whatever it is for the typical wired, ultra high speed wired broadband plan, somewhere between 50 and 100 bucks a month. So yeah, I mean, you want that, and goodness knows if you're willing to pay for a gigabit plan instead of a 100 megabit plan, you probably either you're just getting it for the fun of it, so you can brag about it to your friends, or else you have a very specialized need, because the typical, it turns out the 25.3 standard is actually pretty close to correct for just the ordinary, individual or couple, or maybe somebody with small children that does the kind of normal things that people do, video streaming for entertainment in the evening and some Zoom during the day if you're, working from home. The closest thing you find to a defect in that standard is that the upstream, instead of 3 megabits per second, it could be 5, maybe 10, whatever. But actually, yeah, it's pretty hard to consume more than 25 megabits per second downstream on a sustained basis. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, not even the Zoom calls would do that. The Zoom calls are even, something like this is incredibly, incredibly thin, and the demands really aren't that much.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's high definition. So the last one I did, it was like a little bit better than 1080p, but it's, if it's 720, which is kind of Zoom version of high definition, it 1 to 2 megabits per second is all you need.
Yeah.
You need a little bit more on the downstream than on the upstream side because of just the way Zoom is structured. But yeah, I mean, that'll actually do it for you. So if you're willing to, you're willing to pony up for that gigabit plan, I mean, maybe you should pay a little bit. It shouldn't be just sort of $10 more than the 100 megabit plan. But I mean, that's a business decision. So they're making these arguments now that we're overpaying for broadband. Mm-hmm. And so President Biden issued this executive order of promoting competition, which, I mean, that making competition the sole focus of antitrust law rather than consumer welfare, that's got its whole own set of problems.
Yeah.
that I fortunately I'm not qualified to talk about, not being an economist. You are, but maybe we could do that sometime. But
yeah, it's a reversal of literally 120 some years of law, at least the focus of law. So yes, it has been the last week or so has been a very interesting time period to just think through that clearly something's changed, right? Clearly the agenda has changed, or the direction of the ship has changed. And especially in broadband.